Je suis très heureuse de vous rencontrer aujourd'hui à l'Institut Michel Villiers. Mon cher collègue Olivier Beau et Olivier Joan-Jean ont eu la gentillesse de m'inviter ici comme professeur invité à votre Institut Michel Villiers. Je suis très reconnaissante pour cette invitation et je me réjouis beaucoup de faire votre connaissance. Tout d'abord, je dois m'excuser. Malheureusement, mon français est devenu mauvais depuis mes années à l'école. C'est pourquoi je dois m'adresser à vous en anglais aujourd'hui. L'anglais est aussi la langue internationale de la science, même si nous le regrettons que beaucoup est perdu dans les traductions. En tout cas, cela signifie du travail pour trouver les bons mots. Cela nous avait expérimenté dans le travail à l'édition l'anglaise de Ernst Wolfgang Böckenförde, même si nous avons un très bon traducteur pour le projet, Thomas Dunlap. Mais si vous voulez qu'un ouvrage soit effectué en dehors de la langue du pays, vous devez le traduire en anglaise. Mais je serais complètement débordée pour vous présenter cette entreprise germano-anglaise en français. Alors, je passe maintenant à l'anglais. Je regrette. So, I have to switch now. I'm sorry for speaking English with you, but I'm sure that... well, nowadays, the quartier latin should be the quartier l'anglaise, right? Yeah, as in the... Middle Ages, yeah, when all the professors and students address each other in Latin, yeah. So nowadays it's English, and I hope you have some. You can understand. Of course, you can understand English, but you can understand that. For me, it's really very complicated to switch between two different languages, between Français and English, yeah, and I realized this, yeah, when I prepared my stay here in Paris, that all my French is gone somehow, yeah, and that's my excuse why I have to speak today in English to you. So what I would like to do today first is to provide a brief overview of the life and work of Ernst Wolfgang Böckenförde. Second, to introduce the English edition and to sketch some of the challenges we have faced in the working process. And third, to highlight why we think that Böckenförde is not outdated but still of great importance in the 21st century. When I say we, I mean Miriam Künkler and me. And please bear in mind that everything I will say today that has been worked out together by Miriam and me, since we have undertaken this Böckenförde project as a team from the beginning until now, which has been really a trusting and collegial collaboration and a wonderful experience. However, I should also say that whenever the English of today's lecture seems a bit clumsy and bumpy, yeah, then I am fully responsible. Whereas if you should notice anything like linguistic elegance, this goes probably back to Miriam's writing. She is affiliated with all the English institutions now for two decades. So, who is Ernst Wolfgang Böckenförde? He is one of, as we already heard, Germany's foremost legal scholars and political thinkers. As a scholar of constitutional law, Böckenförde has been a major contributor to contemporary debates in legal and political theory, also to the conceptual framework of the modern state and its presuppositions, and to debates about various political and ethical problems, ranging from the deployment of nuclear missiles, he already discussed this in the 50s, to the ethic of genetic engineering, he discussed in the first decade of this century. As a judge on Germany's Federal Constitutional Court from December 1983 until May 1996, authoring one of the highest number of dissenting opinions in the court's history, 11 dissenting opinions, Böckenförde has influenced the way in which academics and citizens in German-speaking lands thinks about law and politics. His interventions as a scholar and judge have shaped not only academic but also wider public debates from the 1950s to the present. One sentence can be highlighted in this regard, which is maybe even more famous than the author himself. Olivier already mentioned the famous, it's called the dictum, the Böckenförde dictum. The liberal, secularized state draws its life from presuppositions that it cannot itself guarantee. Sometimes it's referred to as a paradox. In my view, the dictum can be seen as a key to his work. We can discuss this later because I know you think the concept of the political is more the key to his work, yeah? But let's see. So Böckenförde pointed to the problem that the modern constitutional state, as a necessarily secular state, cannot resort to imposing certain values or worldviews on its citizens without undermining the very liberalism on which it is founded. The rule of law and democratic procedures, so Böckenförde, cannot be sustained in the long term unless they are carried by people who consider themselves as part of the same demos. Although the liberal state cannot guarantee these presuppositions with legal means of coercion, this does not mean that the hands of the state are totally bound. For instance, the state may maintain an educational system which provides students with the opportunity to develop critical judgment skills. The state could invest in publicly owned media channels, which are, as we can see today again, important elements of well-functioning democracies. And to give a last example, public office holders have the duty to behave lawfully, a very important presupposition in our days. Böckenförde had publicly admonished Helmut Kohl in the CDU party finance scandal, which may be particularly interesting given the temporary arrest of Sarkozy this week. And not to mention the different category of, in my perspectives, sheer criminal politicians, such as Trump and Orban, which are acting only for their self-interest. Against the recent rise of the populist movement, it is of the utmost importance to think about the preconditions of liberal democracies and to assess what may be done to secure this type of political order. I will come back to the ongoing relevance of Böckenförde's work with my third point. So let me now give an overview of his life, his academic career, and his work. Böckenförde grew up in Kassel. What is Kassel? Kassel is a town located in the middle of Germany in North Hesse, which you may know as the place where the International Exhibition of Modern Art, the Documenta, takes place. You've heard about Documenta, right? Before World War II, Kassel was mainly characterized by being just the seat of regional administrative institutions. Böckenförde grew up in a Catholic family with seven siblings. Three of them became later professors, one for church law, yeah, and two for law. His father was a head forester, or another word is a forest councillor, Forstrat. Yeah. And Böckenförde mentioned once that a discursive atmosphere was cultivated at home with, for instance, debates on the quality of the sermon over lunch on Sundays. Born in 1930 and handicapped with a sports-related leg injury, he was not part of what is called the Flakhelper generation. So these were auxiliary helpers, as you could say, teenager soldiers in the German Luftwaffe. So he was not part of this. After his baccalaureate, he studied law and history in Münster, Munich. By the way, he passed his baccalaureate at a gymnasium, at the same gymnasium which Dieter Grimm, which is another former constitutional judge and scholar, attended only a few years later. And I read in a biography on Dieter Grimm that there's also a third former constitutional judge who attended this gymnasium. And Dieter Grimm once said that it needed to have three constitutional judges to compensate for Freisler, who was also a pupil of this gymnasium. Freisler was the most horrible judge in the in Germany we ever had. In the Third Reich, he was the president of the Volksgerichtshof. Yeah. Okay, all came from these gymnasiums. Something has to be with this gymnasium. Pardon?
Who is this? The third.
Yeah, the third. I forget it. I will look it up. Okay, so Birkenfeld studied law and history in Münster and Munich. He received his PhD in law in 1956 with a book on Gesetz and Gesetzgebende Gewalt, that is law and lawmaking power, from the beginnings of German constitutional law to the heights of constitutional legal positivism. In 1960, he received another PhD in history from the University of Munich with a dissertation entitled Die Verfassungsgeschichtliche Forschung im 19. Jahrhundert, that is, the scholarship on constitutional history in the 19th century. His postdoctoral habilitation was successfully submitted in 1964 with a work on organizational power in the realm of government, an inquiry into the public law of the Federal Republic of Germany. So he was quite well equipped with three monographs in constitutional history and public law, specialization in constitutional law. And this already illustrates these monographs, his specific approach of combining law and history. However, some of his mentors were worried regarding his chances to obtain a tenured position in the German university system, because he already had become a well-known figure due to two early articles which turned out to be highly controversial. The first one was on was titled Ethos of Democracy. He wrote that article at the tender age of 27. That was published in the Catholic monthly magazine Hochland. At a time when, from a doctrinal point of view, we are still in the 15s, before Vaticanum II, it was still unacceptable for Catholics to live in a secular state, Birkenförder argued, with 27, that democracy and human rights were the legitimate form of political order from a Christian perspective. And he did so long before Vatican II adopted the same view. He again raised attention when in 1961, while working on his habilitation, he published an article on the role of the Catholic Church in tolerating and implicitly aiding the emergence of the Nazi state in 1933. The article was considered so explosive that several of his mentors either strongly advised against publishing it, or even betted it would not see the light of the day. It was ultimately published in the same Catholic monthly Hochland, and several exchanges between him and his critiques appeared in following editions. The Catholic Church saw itself compelled to convene an association of church-related historians, the Committee for Contemporary History, in response to his article, but it ultimately agreed with most of his findings. Despite this criticism he received, Birkenförder was appointed immediately after he had finished his habilitation as professor for constitutional law and legal theory at the University of Heidelberg in 1964. And here another strand in his early intellectual development has to be taken into account. The appointment in Heidelberg was made possible by law faculty member Ernst Forsthoff, some of you may know as a close colleague and one of the first PhD students of Carl Schmitt in the Weimar Republic. So I needed 15 minutes to mention Carl Schmitt for the first time. And Birkenförder belonged to the Schmitt School, which was commonly seen as being in competition with the other school, the Smend School. Together with Roman Schnur, Birkenförder founded the famous, then later famous journal Der Staat, the State, in the early 60s. That was supposed to be an alternative to the journal Öffentliche Verwaltung, Public Administration, which was seen as the journal operated by the Smend School. From the middle of the 1915s onwards, Böckenförde had an increasingly close relationship with Carl Schmitt. Schmitt's biographer, Reinhard Mehring, held that Böckenförde worked even as the editor of Carl Schmitt's late work. However, this should not to be mistaken as a clear-cut case that Böckenförde has to be seen as a Schmittian. Yeah? For example, Mehring also argues that with Böckenförde, a liberal reception of Schmitt's theory appeared. And we will discuss this later, I'm sure, because Olivier is here. And he has a very clear view on this. Moreover, Schmitt was not the only, how do you say today, influencer, yeah? He was not the only influencer for the young scholar. Besides his PhD advisors Julius Wolf in Münster and the liberal historian Franz Schnabel in Munich, the philosopher and Hegel researcher Joachim Ritter has to be mentioned. And unfortunately that Elodie can't join us today because I wrote this passage for her, but I will give it to her. Ritter held a regularly colloquium in Münster, which Böckenförde often attended. That was called the Collegium Philosophicum. And there has been a PhD dissertation written on this of an intellectual historian, Jens Hacke, and he argues that this colloquium is really decisive for the liberal conservative formation of the early federal republic. So there is not only Habermas or before that Adorno and Horkheimer in Frankfurt, but there's also Münster with this Collegium Philosophicum and Ritter. In this Collegium Philosophicum that Böckenförde met conceptual historian Reinhard Koselleck. You may know him you know Reinhard Koselleck. And he became a professor in Heidelberg in the 1960s as well. And Böckenförde and Koselleck both, they moved together to the newly founded University of Bielefeld in 1969. Later, Böckenförde contributed to Koselleck's famous geschichtliche Grundbegriffe. I'm sure that somewhere we can find the geschichtliche Grundbegriffe here in the library. Yeah. And there you could read his article on organism, yeah, as a metaphor, a famous metaphor especially in the 19th century in the German political and legal language for institutions. In Bielefeld, in the early 70s, then, Böckenförde developed his full critique of the German Constitutional Court's jurisprudence, which from his perspective had since the late 1950s become too programmatic and too activist. Starting with the Lüth decision of 1958, the court decided that the fundamental rights enshrined in the Constitution ought to radiate out into all other spheres of law, and that the state had the duty to ensure they were at the basis not only of the relationship between the individual and the state, but also between the citizens towards one another. Böckenförde did not necessarily object to this view on normative grounds. In fact, in another article, he asks, if the state is and should be an ethical state, building here on Hegel's work. But he objected on methodological grounds. In his article on grounding law and values, also included here in this new volume, he tried to show that it would be futile to do just that, to ground law and values, as this would require the development of reliable hierarchies of values for judges to be consistent. Since to date, such hierarchies of values had not been developed convincingly, and how could this be done at all? Should one always prioritize liberty over equality? Could one develop reliable criteria for exceptions to this rule? So this view of constitutional norms as values, systematized in an objective order, this would lead to nothing else, says Böckenförde, than to judge-made law. His analysis of how constitutional rights after the Lüth case
were no longer only defensive right against state intrusion, but also rights embedded in an allegedly objective order of value, this gave rise to an entire generation of basic rights scholarships in Germany, of which, for instance, Robert Alexis' account has become most international prominent. In 1977, then, he was appointed to the law faculty of the University of Freiburg, where he remained until his retirement. It is in the aftermath of this period, in the late 1970s, that Birkenfeld developed some of his most liberal work. This was done in the context of the emergence of radical leftist movements in West Germany, at the forefront the Red Army faction, which threatened to bring down the young Western German democracy. Reflecting on the 1968 emergency laws that were active at this time in order to deal with the activities, the terrorism of the Red Army faction, Birkenfelder wrote an article titled The Repressed State of Emergency, also included here, in which he argued, somehow provocatively, that the 1968 emergency laws went even beyond the 1933 Enabling Act of the Nazis in allowing the erosion of the rule of law, justified by a war against internal enemies. And he provided then numerous examples of how exactly that had already happened. For instance, the violation that took place of attorney-client privileges, or the installation of eavesdropping devices on regular citizens, and so on. Practices you would assume that they would be happen only in the former GDR. No, they also took place in the Bundesrepublik. So criticizing the 1968 emergency laws and drawing here extensively on Carl Schmitt, to whom the article was dedicated, and Schmitt's differentiation between law and measure, Birkenfelder argued that a state of emergency ought to be embedded in the Constitution and very tightly circumscribed. In a follow-up article, Birkenfelder developed a blueprint of a constitutional amendment that would fulfill the criteria he had outlined earlier for a state of emergency that would be rights preserving as much as possible rather than rights eroding. This period was followed then by a 12-year period during which he served as a judge on Germany's Federal Constitutional Court. And during that time, for obvious reason, he published very little, as it is customary for judges on the bench. However, he still found a way to express himself individually. As I already said, he wrote 11 dissenting opinions, which is about three times as much as usual. The only time that I did some empirical research is I tried to figure out what is the relationship here. So three times as much as usual. In some cases, the dissenting vote influenced later majority opinions, as happened, for example, with regard to the party financing case. So at one year you are in the minority, but still on the bench, you have the chance to once become the writer of the majority opinion. After his retirement from the court, he focused on his fourth larger monograph. Olivier already mentioned it. He published his lecture on the history of law and state theory, Geschichte der Rechts- und Staatsphilosophie, now already available in the second edition. Yeah. He had given these lectures regularly in Freiburg University. The book ranges from the ancient classics over Christian philosophy of the state to Augustine, Thomas, and late Ibero-Scholasticism, and concludes with a chapter on Luther. Unfortunately, he never wrote the planned second volume on the modern state and legal philosophy. However, he wrote a single article focusing on Thomas Hobbes and the paradigm shift in the foundation of law from natural law to a positive law system. Furthermore, from the 1990s onwards, he focused passionately on those questions which had been set on the political agenda: European integration, bioethics, and how democracy can accommodate the challenges emanating from an increasingly religiously diverse citizenry. His perspective on the principle of religious and ideological neutrality of the state has attracted a lot of attention, and I will say a few words on this in the third part, where I will lay out his thought on law, democracy, and religion. So concluding this overview, I think that it is very difficult to pigeonhole Birkenfelder on a left-right continuum. I should add that Birkenfelder is not only a committed Catholic, but he also joined the Social Democrats, the SPD, in the 1960s. In both institutions, he participated actively. So he was a member of the Central Committee of the German Catholic Laics, and from time to time, a legal advisor for the SPD on a national level. Accordingly, Birkenfelder appears progressive in some ways. So for instance, for him, dual citizenship does not pose a problem of torn loyalty. And also he thinks welfare state is necessary to accommodate capitalism. But in other ways, he seems conservative. For instance, he says people need grounding in families and states need to mold their students in school. Nicht zurechtweisen, aber formen. Ja?
Formen.
Ja, so.
Mhm. Mulde.
Ja.
Mulde.
Ja. Mulde. Ja, Form. Ja.
Mulde.
Ja, ja. Ja. Mhm. Ja. Ja, so it's we need to have critical students. So it's necessary that there is really.
Mulde d'étudiants, mulde de gâteau, mais mulde d'étudiants.
Mais.
Il faut trouver une traduction plus. Déformée.
Mettre dans un moule. Oui. Les mettre dans un moule. Non, non, oui. C'est plus que ça.
Oui, c'est plus que ça.
C'est bien dans un moule.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Nous moulons des étudiants.
Les former, c'est bien.
Former, ok.
Fin de la parenthèse, pardon.
No, that's right. So we can see, so Birkenfelder writes as a committed Catholic, as a social democrat, and as a political liberal altogether. As a Catholic, he is concerned with questions of social cohesion, political community, and the ethical foundations of the state. What holds the citizenry together? Should the state promote certain worldviews over others, which he ultimately negates? As a social democrat, he deeply cares about not only political, but also economic and social justice, injustices. Here he builds on the work of 19th century political thinker Lorenz von Stein, who sometime before Marx already argued in favor of the social welfare state against the backdrop of the emergence of industrial capitalism. For Birkenfelder, it is a duty of the democratic state to address economic injustices, and no political stability can be achieved without social and economic security. Moreover, certain rights cannot be enjoyed without certain socio-economic conditions being met first. Ultimately, Birkenfelder believes it is the liberal democratic state which may need to provide for these conditions if society does not. So the state has to compensate for the lacks, for the deficits in society. Finally, as a political liberal, he has argued fervently in favor of protecting the rights of minorities, especially of individuals who belong to religious minorities, such as in the headscarf debate. Yeah, so he was against the prohibitions of headscarves in schools, even for teachers. Did Birkenfelder then found a school of thought of his own that would integrate these various influences? Here, an interesting observation has been made by Germany's former president, Joachim Gauck, in April 2016, while awarding Birkenfelder really the highest order of merit, which was only the last and highest award in a long series of awards he got. Among these so different ones, like the Hannah Arendt Prize of Political Thinking he received. And I remember this occasion very well because I had the honor
to give the Laudatio together with Joachim Gauck for Birkenförde. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then Gauck, a decade later or 12 years later, in his position as president of the of Germany, he awarded him this highest order of merit. Yeah? He also got awards from John Paul II and a lot of different university faculties. So Gauck observed, quote, "You were clearly reluctant to found a school of thought of your own. Instead, it was more important for you that your doctoral and other postgraduate students developed arguments and approaches independently and with courage. In this discursive manner, you have actually brought into being a Birkenförde school of its own particular stamp, a school of free intellectual self-development," unquote. So with regard to his entire oeuvre, and I could only give you a very superficial insight into it, with regard to this entire oeuvre, we thought that Birkenförde deserves international reception, not merely as a testimony to a classic strand of German political and legal thinking beyond Hans Kelsen and Carl Schmitt, who are obviously the most famous ones, yeah, but also as a historically rooted, normatively firm, and sharp analytical body of work that help its readers to understand the modern state as a political order deeply connected to the law. That is why we have decided to edit a representative selection of articles, most of them translated for the first time into English. So let me go on to present you the edition project. Birkenförde's writing have been met with wide-ranging reception in the German academic world. Besides several Festschriften, a number of anthologies and monographs have been published about his work. In addition to the mentioned numerous prizes, he has also received 5 honorary doctorates. And his writings have been translated into many languages, into Korean in 1992, into Polish, Japanese, French, yeah. And a lot of translation has been done in Italian. Single essays have also been translated in Portuguese, Spanish, and Swedish. Surprisingly, however, thus far only a very small number of his essays had appeared in English, most notably in a small collection by Berg Publishers in the early 90s, which is now out of print, and we intended to change that. After all, a thinker whose writings are not accessible in the lingua franca of science in English, I already mentioned this in the beginning in my broken Francais, may soon be known only by a small circle of experts. It took some time before we found suitable publishing houses for our idea, which would be able to appreciate the project. We wrote the first synopsis for the planned 2 volumes. I remember it very well because that was the year when I started in Kiel in 2009. Yeah, and many more followed, with Ernst Wolfgang Birkenförde accompanying the project very liberally and patiently over the years. He granted us as editors great liberty with regards to the material, but we nevertheless made all the decisions together with him in consensual fashion. In the end, we had offers from both Cambridge University Press and Oxford University Press, and finally settled on OUP and this wonderful series, Constitutional Theory. Olivier Beau already introduced you to the series. The 2 volumes contain what we consider to be his most important writings, most of which have been translated into English for the first time. The first volume is entitled Constitutional and Political Theory, and this brings together Birkenförde's main constitutional and political theoretical essays, while the second volume will be entitled Religion, Law and Democracy, will focus on issues of religion, ethics and morality. If you can have a look into it.
Le livre s'appelle Reviens.
Okay. So let me give you a little bit an insight of the structure of the 2 volumes. So we have four parts in it, each containing four of his most important essays. So here we have the first part in volume one on political theory of the state. Yeah, there is a very famous one, The Concept of the Political, a Key to Understanding Carl Schmitt's Constitutional Theory. Very nice reconstruction of Schmitt's concept of the political. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this article on Hegel, the state as an ethical state, and we start with the article on Hobbes. So here you can see Birkenförde as a thinker of in the history of political ideas. Yeah, and then the second part is on constitutional theory, what the constitutional state is about, how the historical evolution had taken place, and my favorite here is the article on constituent power of the people, where he goes back to Sieyès, yeah, and the differentiation which you are all familiar with on pouvoir constituant and pouvoir constitué, yeah, and he presented the pouvoir constituant as a liminal concept, yeah, where law and politics actually meet. That's really a great one, yeah. And we have here a comparative work on constitutional jurisdiction, where he compared different types or models of the structure of constitutional courts, also very clear and still valid, I would assume. In the third part, there we have included the most important articles on fundamental rights and constitutional principles. There you will find his idea that in every basic fundamental right, there are two sides, yeah, the side that with which you can fight against state intrusion, and the other side that you can ask for more state action, yeah, the subjective and the objective side of rights, yeah. That is the that was a hard thing to translate or put. I will say a word on the translation issues later. Fundamental rights as constitutional principles. But also we included here a chapter on the different theories, how to interpret fundamental rights. And in part four, we included articles more of political nature, where he elucidated the relationship between state, citizenship, and political autonomy. Yeah? So interestingly, he referred to the persecution of the German Jews not only as the most horrible event in history we have, but also as a civic betrayal, because the German Jews were citizens, and it was a betrayal within the citizenry. Yeah, that was a new perspective in the 80s when he wrote this article. Also here you can find a review of a famous book of Roger Brubaker on nationality, and in this review essay he compared the different models of citizenship. I think also the French and the German and the US one. Mm-hmm. And there are his two articles on the future of the European integration, and he's very skeptical. He was very skeptical, and it turned out to be that I'm afraid that he's somehow right in his perspectives. Mm. We also included part of a biographical interview that Dieter Gosewinkel, a historian and legal scholar, conducted with him in 2009-2010, and which illuminates some contextual issues. And you can see in the volume we also made a lot of annotations in the essays. Yeah, we wrote introductions, a general introduction, and to each of the parts, a section introduction, and we introduced annotations which briefly explain persons, places, and relevant context, because we assume that especially US American readers may not necessarily know what a red-green coalition is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so with regard to time, maybe I skipped the volume two, yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I say something about the translation problems we faced. The translation of the essays was carried out by Thomas Dunlap. He also translated Michael Stolley's four-volume History of Public Law in Germany. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. into English. So he was very well prepared for this challenge, to translate Birkenförder. The four of us, so Mirjam, Thomas, and Professor Birkenförder, we met in Freiburg and discussed some of the difficulties in person. For despite the translator's vast experience, expertise pertaining to legal and historical questions, the translation of certain concepts still pose challenges. For example, so, and maybe some of you know a little bit German, how would you translate the concept of Wertgesetzlichkeit des Geistes, which appears in the particularly demanding essay zur Kritik der Wertbegründung des Rechts, Kritik of the Value-Based Grounding of Laws. In the end, we decided for, and even the English is hard to understand, historical, culturally shaped, nomological dimension of values for Wertgesetzlichkeit des Geistes. Or how to translate Birkenförder's usage of Hermann Heller's concept of Staat als Handlungseinheit, and eventually we opted here for the state as a unifying framework of action. And another example, sounds in the beginning very, very easy, Grundsatznorm. Yeah, you even don't have to understand German to know what Grundsatznorm could mean. But in Hans Kelsen's theory, the word Grundnorm was translated as basic norm. So we couldn't go for basic norm. Yeah, that was, that would cause a misunderstanding, yeah, what to do. And here, finally, we decided on constitutional principle. This is already an interpretation. Robert Alexi said this on occasion of a book launch in Kiel. He was so nice to present the book in Kiel. But we also wanted to emphasize the close relationship to the principles that Alexi describes as Principien Normen, yeah, and the translator of Robert Alexi, Julian Rivers, we are also in contact with him, he translated Alexi's Principien Normen into Principle Norm. And thus we decided for Birkenförder's Grundsatznorm into constitutional principles, because there are some similarities between the two concepts. Many scholars have helped us in this regard. Yeah, Martin Lovelin, of course, and a lot of others you don't know, that's why I don't mention them. It's impolite, but you don't know them anyway. Maybe you do know Stanley Paulsen. He's the Kelsen and Radbruch expert in the US, and he helped us a lot.
It's the only one, Kelsen expert.
Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, but also Radbruch. He's also working on Radbruch as well. So in order to make Birkenförder's work and the present volume known to a broader non-German speaking audience, Olivier already mentioned, we organized two conferences in 2016, each with about 25 participants who were invited to discuss the writings. And what Olivier also already had mentioned, there will be three special issues coming up this year, one in Constellations. Constellations is the journal for democratic theory, where a lot of the critical theory camps belong to, but not only. And the contributions in this issue will analyze, in particular, Birkenförder's political and democratic theory, his concept of secularization, and also the context of his famous dictum, and his work in comparison to Schmidt and Heller. Second, there will be the special issue in the Oxford Journal of Law and Religion. In this issue, aspects of his writings on freedom of conscience, his understanding of so-called positive neutrality of the states towards religious communities, and the relationship between secular and religious law are being discussed. And third, there will be this special issue of the German Law Journal with about a dozen essays on various aspects of Birkenförder's work on constitution and basic rights, and these articles apply his concepts to non-German contexts. For instance, applying his ideas on the state of emergency to France, to the UK, to Scandinavia, and to India, because in all these countries we have currently a lot of hot debates how the threat of terrorism should be addressed.
Okay, so I will skip this a bit, and then I will come to my last point and will tell you a bit why we think that Birkenfeld still is relevant. During the book launches we organized last year, some critical remarks were made with regard to the question of Birkenfeld's continuing relevance. So it was said he might be a classic for legal and political thought on the German democratic constitutional state, but can we think with him beyond this nation state? Also taking into account his skepticism towards European integration, Ulrich Kaprois has raised this question on several discussions I had with him on Birkenfelder. Furthermore, Christoph Möllers has identified a number of weak points of Birkenfelder's thought, for example, his construal of the relationship between the executive and the legislature, which would perhaps fit better with a 19th century constitutional monarchy than it does with a modern democracy. Also Christoph Schönberger joined him in this critique. Other scholars, such as Oliver Lepsius, also professor invitisi, he has criticized his chain of legitimation concept. Yeah? Namely, with this chain of legitimation concept is meant that all state power has to be derived from the people, or bottom up. A concept which, as a matter of fact, then has been used by state administrations to implement states' policies on a local level against the local people's will. And finally, one might add that in his extensive oeuvre, some contemporary challenges, like the crisis of the human relations to nature, are not addressed at all. I'm a little bit bothered by this lack in his writing. So one could say, is Birkenfelder outdated? As editors of his work, we wish to refrain from being sheer apologetic. We also recognize that Birkenfelder is a thinker whose thought is in some ways very much connected to the German Federal Republic. However, we also think that his concepts and analysis are so insightful that they may help to shed light onto other political and cultural contexts than the German one. And this can indeed has been shown in the articles of the upcoming special issues. So now in a final part, I would like to refer to two recent political challenges and how Birkenfelder may help us to address them, the rise of populism, and second, the development of what is called the post-secular society, meaning that there is a decrease of the Christian population and an increase of religious plurality. I will end with some concluding remarks on natural law, which I'm especially happy to do so here given the name giver of the Institute. So first, relative homogeneity as a necessary condition in democracies, question mark. Considering the challenges constitutional democracies are facing today, Birkenfelder's writings could hardly be more relevant. In the already quoted dictum, the liberal, secularized state draws its life from presuppositions that it cannot itself guarantee, Birkenfelder pointed to the problem that societies, in particular those of liberal states, are in the need of a shared sense of belonging that binds them together. Although one may see a connection of the dictum to Carl Schmitt's concern with the survival of the state in a time of crisis, that was a sound of the 60s. There's always a crisis, yeah, and you have to face this challenge and find an answer to the crisis of the state. But for Birkenfelder, this should not be seen to conflict with plurality. As a necessarily secular state, I already said this, it cannot resort to imposing certain values or worldviews on its citizens without undermining the very liberalism on which it is founded. That's a paradox. So the rule of law and democratic procedures, so Birkenfelder, cannot be sustained in the long term unless they are carried by the people who consider themselves part of the same demos. That is what he means with the concept social homogeneity, a socio-psychological condition, as he writes, that binds the people to one another, to one citizenry, that bind the people together, and that prompts them to work towards a common good. And in this regard, it is helpful to draw a line to the Weimar Republic antipodes in German Staatsrechtslehre, so constitutional law theory. Both Hermann Heller and Carl Schmitt, and Olivier knows much more about this than I do, both Heller and Schmitt conceived homogeneity as a precondition for the modern state, but whereas Heller had a rather constructivist notion of homogeneity, Schmitt was more ambiguous. While in the 20s, Schmitt described empirically what could make up for homogeneity, culture, language, ethnicity, he sounded like a social scientist, yeah? But this changed immediately after 33. Then he invoked racial criteria in his writings for homogeneity, yeah? That there has to be a racial Gleichartigkeit. Because Birkenförde drew extensively on Schmitt regarding his writings on sovereignty, representation, and many concepts in constitutional law, some scholars have suggested that accordingly Birkenförde relies on Schmitt with regard to the concept of homogeneity. Birkenförde himself states that he draws on Heller rather than Schmitt, and indeed he starts to use the concept only in the mid-60s after having written about Heller's work. Here also Adolf Arndt comes into play, an influential legal advisor of the Social Democrats in the 50s and 60s. And he said that in a democracy, there need to be a consensus on the things that cannot be voted upon. I love this very much. In a democracy, there need to be a consensus on the things that cannot be voted upon. What binds the people together consists of an implicit agreement. Most importantly, the principles of democracy, the rule of law, liberalism. So a shared understanding about these, you could in this way say, although these are political principles, it's need a pre-political basis of the political community that needs to be constantly recreated by the people themselves. Birkenförde held that the sense of belonging cannot be produced and enforced by the state. Rather, as mentioned, he thinks that it has to emerge from civil society and from the ethos of individuals as citizens that is directed to the common good. However, the state may support institutions where individuals and groups create and develop this ethos. Many democracies suffer today from deep polarization, pondered by growing economic inequality and increasingly separate life worlds with divergent cultural outlooks, nationalist versus cosmopolitan, particularist versus universalist, and laissez-faire versus regulatory views of government. New culture wars have emerged, accompanied by new nationalist populisms. Birkenförde's writings on how plural societies need to and can come to a shared understanding of their responsibilities to one another as citizens, and which tools are at the disposal of the state in this undertaking, and which ones of society, we think are of central interest in our time. Second, the principle of open and encompassing neutrality for post-secular societies. Birkenförde conceives the relationship between law, politics, and religion in the frame of basic rights and anthropology of personhood. He regards freedom of conscience and religion not only as one of the key human rights, but as the most important human right, as it enables one to distinguish between good and evil and to act accordingly. This is obviously a biblical anthropology. The liberal state respects and protects the individual's core of his or her personality, namely that he or she feels bound to the outcome of the individual reasoning in his or her forum internum, be this forum internum of religious or philosophical nature. More specifically, religious freedom means for Birkenförde the right to have or not to have a religious faith, freedom of religion, to affirm this faith privately or openly, and to advocate or not advocate it, freedom of profession, to exercise or not exercise one's religion publicly, freedom of worship, and to join or not join together into religious communities, religious freedom of association. The correlate to this individual right is the open and encompassing principle of the state's religious and ideological neutrality, religiös weltanschauliche Neutralität, religious and ideological neutrality of the state. This in principle entails, first and foremost, a prohibition for the state to justify law on religious grounds. So you cannot justify a law with the Bible or with the Quran or whatever writings, or not with Marxism. Yeah, this applies to religious as well as to Weltanschauung, to worldviews. Furthermore, it entails the dissociation of political authority from religious authority and requires of the state to not privilege religion over non-religion and one religious community over another. In the article The Secularized State of 2006, Birkenfelder explicitly juxtaposes his concept of an open neutrality versus that of distancing neutrality, and regarding the latter, the distancing neutrality, of course, he had France in mind. Yeah? The latter tends, quote, toward consigning and confining religion to the private and private social sphere. It shapes the legal system in a purely secular way and turns away religious aspects as irrelevant and private, unquote. Encompassing open neutrality, by contrast, quote, additionally accords it room to develop in the public sphere, for example, in the school, educational institutions, and in what is summarily referred to as the public order, though, of course, it does so without any form of identification. It seeks to create a balance in that affirming and leading a life in accordance with religion to the extent that it is compatible with the secular goals of the state, is permitted also within the public sphere by the legal system, and is incorporated into the latter, unquote. So while distancing neutrality champions negative religious freedom, the freedom not to be religious, open neutrality, he argues, aims for a balancing of negative and positive religious freedom. So the right to live one's life in accordance with one's religion's tenets. And he thinks that this fits better for a diverse religious society. What does open neutrality then entail? In practice, the rights and interests of the religious and non-religious need to be weighed on a case-by-case basis. With regard to the presence, for instance, of religious symbols in public spaces, it is necessary then to distinguish between, let's say, courtrooms and classrooms. Regarding the display of crucifixes in courtrooms, Birkenfelder argued that they could be perceived by individuals as an infringement on their negative freedom of conscience and should therefore be removed. In courtrooms, where the state engaged in a sovereign activity, distancing neutrality towards religion ought to be applied. Different in schools. In schools, unlike courtrooms, were not, he argues, schools are not institutions of the state as an entity of power, but intermediary institutions that connect state and society. Public schools are, quote, a means through which the state fulfills its duty of civic education, not indoctrination in favor of that there is no religion in the world, yeah? Unquote. The regulation of the presence of religious symbols, therefore, allowed for a different solution, one of open and encompassing neutrality that allowed citizens to show themselves as religious or non-religious being at their own pleasing, including in wearing religious garb. By no means does Birkenfelder think that the relation between the religious and the secular is always peacefully and mutually supportive. Birkenfelder examined the possible tension between religious and secular commitments in an article titled as Christian in the office of constitutional judge, in which he looked back on his years on the constitutional bench. In this office, he was exclusively bound by the law and the bonum commune, the good of the entire citizenry. Particularist concerns or interests, such as those of a Catholic, had no place in the inner deliberative process of the court, Birkenfelder wrote. As a public official, one is accountable to the entire demos, and as such cannot allow oneself to formulate positions based on a particularist identity. Religion can and should inform the individual ethos, but religious reasons cannot guide a decision-making process in jurisdiction, whose results then apply to all citizens, regardless of their inner convictions. And there's an interesting debate on Germany if this proviso should also apply to the parliament debate. Yeah, mm-hmm. Habermas said so. He said that in the parliament, the members should not refer to religious reasons. Yeah, and I think that Birkenfelder would not go that far. Yeah. So let me come now to a concluding remark with regard to natural law of ethical reasoning. Let me conclude here with the place Birkenfelder designated for natural law. And I have to admit that it has been a decade or more since I read and tried to understand Michel Villiers' La Formation de la Pensée Juridique Moderne and the respective critique of Brian Tierney. Mm-hmm. I cannot say anymore who convinced me more with regard to the question when, where, and by whom the idea of rights as subjective rights was invented. Was it in the 14th century by William of Ockham, or already in the writings of the 12th century's canonists? I don't know. I do remember that Villiers was reluctant to embrace human rights, since in a culture of rights, justice becomes, as he wrote, quote, merely a label that we put on our own subjective preferences, unquote. Indeed, in a secular state, there is no other way than to define by ourselves what justice is. And we do so in a constitutional democracy in the frame set by the procedural and substantive constraints of the Constitution. Referring to justice as embedded in human rights and human dignity, and then to discuss politically how, for instance, a proper balance of freedom and equality should look like, to me, this is not an act of sheer subjectiveness. And in this regard, the concept of natural law fulfills a specific and rather procedural function in a secular democracy. According to Birkenfelder, natural law provides vis-a-vis positive law an ethical reasoning. It entails crucial resources to legitimize or criticize, to direct and correct state law. For Birkenfelder, in a liberal and secular state, these functions can only be guaranteed by a specific kind of legal ethics, namely one that does not undercut the exclusive claim to validity of the positive law of the state. In accordance with his early critique of the Catholic Church, Birkenfelder argues in his later writings on natural law that the traditional Catholic natural law doctrine is untenable as long as it is still understood as a system of meta-positive norms with a claim to validity that rivals positive state law. That is not how we should address natural law. It is more than evident, Birkenfelder holds, that such a conception would necessarily delegitimize the political order of constitutional democracy, in which only the democratic sovereign has the rightful authority to make and enforce binding laws. At the same time, he has shown how natural law as ethical reasoning provides an important source to enrich public discourse. For example, in the public debate on biopolitics, which is fueled by medical progress in stem cell research. So let me conclude in one sentence to put it in a nutshell. In Birkenfelder's person and thought, a rather unlikely and very unusual coexistence of liberal Catholicism, Hegelianism, social democratism, and of course statism, etatism,
is reconciled with democracy. And maybe I think this is the reason why we are still fascinated by this great thinker, although we are working on him now for years and years, and it never gets boring. Okay, thank you so much.